So welcome to another episode of Beta Talk. I'm in Wales and I'm with some very special guests because I'm with my sponsors. So I'm sponsored by the Welsh Government Optimised Retrofit Programme that is managed by Ciro, and I'm with two of the co-founders of Ciro. We've got James and we've got Andy, and I'm also joined by Lee, who now works for Ciro, and Lee has been on the podcast at least a couple of times. So I think the first question I want to ask is, what is Optimised Retrofit, Andy?
Good question. So Optimised Retrofit is a couple of things. One, from a Welsh Government perspective, it's a Welsh Government programme to try and deliver homes towards net zero carbon, ultimately. For us, it's a particular Pathfinder programme within that journey, where we're working with 28 social landlords and other partners to help them understand their housing stock and take it forward on a journey to net zero. But overall, what we would say when we're talking about an optimised retrofit is it's a retrofit which is taking that home, any home, on a journey towards net zero carbon, and doing that in alignment or in harmony with the energy grids. So not necessarily all in one go, in a series of interventions over time that are all considered and thought through, but ultimately arriving at net zero carbon, working in harmony with the energy grid.
So you create kind of a pathway. You just don't go in and start insulating everywhere and changing it. You're creating pathways for individual homes then.
Yeah, absolutely. An optimised retrofit is a retrofit which starts with a plan. You know, all the best work happens when you have a plan at the start and you then implement the plan. So recognising that some elements of a building will have some life left in them, don't necessarily tear them out and throw them away. There's life left in the old boiler, for example. But you need a plan when you replace that you put in the right low carbon or zero carbon heat source, that your property is ready for that. So maybe you've looked at RADs, maybe you've looked at fabric efficiency, air tightness measures, so that when you replace it, it's replaced as part of a wider plan. And an optimised retrofit is saying, get the plan in place, remember that the grid is decarbonising, work everything through, and then over time implement that plan.
So one of the things I promote is you've got to go in first and survey and measure stuff in any property, and that sounds like what you guys do, don't you?
Absolutely, yeah. A key starting point for any optimised retrofit is to get a really good quality survey of the home. So one of the tools that we've built with Ciro is the Capture survey tool, and that's designed to align with PAS 2035, which I know that listeners will be very familiar with. It captures all the information that you'd need to be able to properly assess the unique qualities of that home. So that's the key thing. So many measures over the previous decades have had issues where there's been an assumption, measures first, oh, we can put EWI on that whole terrace. Well, actually, maybe you can't. The end one is a different circumstance. It's got a different microclimate. There's a tree, there's a blocked gutter. Something's different. Every home is unique, and unless you're capturing that, you're probably building in failure. So yeah, capture from the start. That's what the survey tool does, and that means that your journey starts from a good starting point.
And this is exactly the same thing, and we've had the wonderful Colin King, who does some work from you, and he was at BRE, I think, with you, wasn't he, back in the day, and I think he's had something to do with PAS 2035, and it's exactly what he sort of inculcates. You've got to get that pathway right, and you can't do measures that aren't in sequence. So I just want to bring you into Ciro. What's Ciro all about? You founded it in 2017, I believe, is that right?
Yeah, we actually started as a house building, a zero carbon house builder. So Ciro Homes came first, and we thought we'll do it ourselves, but actually we realised that would take us a long time to kind of get to the level of impact that we wanted to. You know, we had plans to do hundreds of thousands of homes. So it was about 6 months later that we set up Ciro Technologies, which is a technology company that is collaborating on other people's housing developments and housing stock. So it was all, my background was in energy, and you know, and Andy's is in buildings and architecture. So we were doing that usual thing of sat in the pub saying, why don't energy and construction really, you know, harmonize the work that they're doing together to actually put in solutions that unlock benefits on both sides. So our approach has always been to make getting to net zero easier. And now, you know, we do that through, as Andy said, through the principle of a building passport. But we support the journey all the way along. So from identifying what we've got, what we're starting with, and that could be an existing building or it could be a new home that hasn't been built yet that is on a plan. How do we take that building to net zero through that pathway approach. But we don't stop there. I think construction has had a habit of handing over to the end user, and our plan has always been to stay involved and to support that solution through, see it through, make sure that actually it delivers those sorts of savings in practice, make sure it delivers that customer experience that we really want new technology to do. So, which is why we continue to stay involved through what we call Cero Life, which is our comfort as a service proposition.
So is this like this heat as a service? We've talked about heat as a service on this podcast before. It's a term that sometimes confuses some people, but you guys are already doing heat as a service, aren't you?
Yeah, so the reason we've called it comfort as a service is because it very much includes those energy. It's not just about supplying one thing into that building, whether energy or heat. It's about that building performing to provide a level of comfort for the customer. So, and ultimately that's what we want people to experience, is better levels of comfort that are more convenient at a lower carbon footprint. So, and the reason we started with that is because we recognize that now we're putting technologies into homes where you can generate, you can store, you can import and export, and really electricity prices change every 30 minutes. That's a really confusing environment for a customer. Really, what most people want to do, and I mean, I know you and I might want to sit there and decide whether the battery is charging or the car is charging, but most people want to worry about feeding the kids or, so they don't want to have to worry about that. So from our perspective, we see this as you set your level of comfort, and in the background, we deliver that at the lowest possible carbon footprint and the lowest possible cost. So we're not a regulated supplier. We're partnered to Octopus to achieve this, but we really are making sure that the home provides that outcome. So and also it's helping support customers who may be unfamiliar with those technologies. Why is my heat pump coming on in the middle of the night? Well, actually it needs to run for longer. We can have those sorts of conversations with customers, and we do. So
this is up and running. You've got customers that are getting this service at the moment?
Yeah, so we have around 60 customers at the moment in Wales, and the program of retrofit that we're rolling out, this service is being sort of taken up by our kind of customers, and we're working very much within the sort of fuel poor and that part of the market through social housing, of course. So we believe that we can have a huge impact on fuel poverty, because we can increase the level of comfort whilst reducing the costs through the technology and through the way that it's bought and managed.
And we all know that's actually quite important now, isn't it? Now, Lee, you're a heating engineer like myself, and you've come to work with Cero. What sort of heating technology are these buildings, or these optimised retrofit buildings, sort of looking at implementing?
Yeah, the best stuff, I think, would be the simple way of putting it. To be honest, it varies. We don't have one set of rules. I think technology agnostic is not a cliche, but that's the phrase we often use, because it genuinely does depend. I think we have a preference towards gram source heat pumps over air source marginally, but again, that depends on the project and what's going in, and obviously, again, new builds very different to retrofit. It's an interesting part of my role. I've been in meetings today with these gents where we're trying to preempt where properties are going. Do we need to assume that most retrofits will need a water tank at some point, or to try and guess where that technology is going? But it's an interesting challenge. But yeah, we obviously fit also smart hot water cylinders which go into the homes, which have offers. I'm speaking to you about this earlier as well, Nathan, where it gives us a real level, good level of detail. It's quite fascinating to be able to see how much hot water there is in a tank, rather than just know how hot that tank is, and that lets you really tweak and have a really good level of control over that home, and you can maybe push the tanks a little bit further than you otherwise would if you didn't have access to that data.
So I imagine you collect loads of data within your homes, don't you?
The graphs we have, I often get shouted at because it's not my role, but I often just nip onto the dashboard and have a look around a few homes and see how they're behaving. But we get 15-minute intervals of the temperatures in every room. and heat meter readings, you know, we can see the efficiencies. We're not quite at the point we can see live COP, but we're on that journey and we will be there fairly soon. To be able to see that at regular intervals, it not only does it let you evaluate your own performance, you know, from building the home, whether it's retrofit or new build, we can actually see that data. We can then use that information to feed in the plans for what we do in the future. And it also, from, I know when Kieran, our colleague, was speaking to today, you know, we can see faults. We can genuinely see if something's broken in a home potentially before the resident knows about it. Like, hang on a minute, that cylinder normally heats up quicker than that. Something's amiss.
We have actually replaced a heat pump before the house has gone as cooled to the level that the occupant has actually noticed it. So that's, you know, yeah, that's happened in, you know, live. We you know, that, and that's the opportunity that the service model can bring. You know, that's, and you know, with technology and with data, is that, you know, that it needs to be. We've always said that the transition to net zero has to feel like a step forward. We can't feel like we're having to make sacrifices. So actually, that extra level of service and care is an opportunity to win over the general public on moving towards renewable heating systems.
And it's worth remembering, not just as a comfort of service, providing a better outcome for the residents, for the people that living in that home, potentially spotting faults before they're even aware of them, but from a construction industry perspective, what we're effectively doing is post-occupancy evaluation for every home that we're working on. So performance gap, well, that's not going to be there for very long. Once we're monitoring every home for every 15 minutes for all of these systems, we can really start to target that, because we stay with the home after practical completion, when most of the construction industry steps away and goes, right, had my fee, got your 5% retention, but I'm off. You know, we're still there. We're running the system on behalf of the customer to give them the outcome of comfort. But if something's not working, then we've got the warranties, we've got the routes to go back and actually make sure that that performance gap isn't there. And of course, as you know very well, that's one of the big challenges we face, is a performance gap in construction.
Yeah, it's something we've talked, or something I talked about with Colin King, I think, and because we've got this notion, and as we know on the news at the moment, we've got this Insulate Britain First, and I've always argued, as you probably would, and because you come from BRE and you're an architect, and you probably know more about this than me, but insulation is actually a science in its own right, and it's very easy to get wrong. And if you get it wrong on buildings like vapor open buildings, where you need to understand moisture migration, it can go drastically wrong. It's not just a case of you just going in there and just banging insulation everywhere, is it?
Absolutely not. And that's where the Pathways to Zero tool that we're launching early in the new year really comes into its own. What we've built there is a complex engine that sits with the power of cloud computing, but allows the user of that tool to work out what the right journey for that home is. And this is that core optimized retrofit journey. So yes, reducing the energy demands from the fabric is absolutely critical. We're likely to be taking most homes on a journey towards electrification. That's likely to be the most common outcome across the housing stock of the UK. But that involves getting the fabric demands down. It involves understanding the hot water demands and the unregulated demands, making sure that we've enabled them to shift. But when it comes to fabric, if you're just, as you say, just plastering insulation everywhere, then vapor open, vapor closed, you need to understand it. You need to understand the ventilation issues. You need to understand potentially overheating issues. That's becoming much, much more common and will do until we get it built in properly. So the Pathways to Zero tool allows us to automate all of the technical elements of that decision-making process and run really quite complicated algorithms under the hood, but present to the user of the tool a very simple interface to say, okay, this is the sequence of measures I want to do for this home, and give them all of those safety checks of, actually, the way you've just deployed those measures is a risk of overheating, or it's a risk of fuel poverty, or it's a risk of trapping moisture as interstitial condensation. You know, we can run the technical bits in the background. That's what computers are good at. The human preferences, well, that's what humans are good at. So you can choose how you want the home to go on its journey, and then that computer can run the process underneath to understand where the risks are and how to avoid them.
I think someone quite clever once said, success is the journey, not the destination. And it seems this is what you're about. This destination, this pathway, and doing the right thing at each incremental step is very sort of paramount to what you guys do, isn't it?
There's a lot of things I love about the Pathways approach, but, you know, one of those, it's that having that eye on the future. So you just think, oh, well, hang on, you know, we might not be fitting the heat pump today, but we we'll be doing in 8 years potentially. So let's think about those pipes going there, or when we're doing the rewire, let's get the cabling deployed ready for the intelligent energy system, or because there will be a battery. But again, it's and just a simple thing that we've been lacking it across construction. You know, the amount of times you see a road dug up for gas works and then a year later it's dug up for the new fibre cable going in. Whereas with our pathways tool, it will literally, oh, that roof needs replacing, does it? Well, bear in mind, you want PV on there within the next X, and also there's EWI going on, so look at extending the eaves. And it makes you consider those junctions and edges again, and Colin can quote, but it's to have that long-term view for the property.
There's another really key point here that, you know, you see all the time in the press that we call this a cost, a bill, we're going to have to spend this much. You know, we're not talking enough about what the savings are, you know, the future savings are in things like energy efficiency. So so having that forward looking approach is really helpful in order to start to suggest this as an investment, you know, and thinking long term about what sort of investment this is. Because, you know, I think that's the one thing I keep banging on about, that we keep talking about net zero as a cost. It's not. It's an investment, and it's a long-term saving. But we just need to be able to quantify and measure that effectively.
I think that's a really good point. It's one of the challenges we've had in the industry historically is we tend to use reduced data standard assessment procedure, RDSAP. I know many listening will understand that, or the full version of SAP as is effectively our national calculation methodology. It's there as a minimum compliance tool. Now, what we are currently doing as an industry is we're expecting a minimum compliance tool to accurately forecast the minute foibles of an individual property. It's not what it's built for. It's built to demonstrate minimum compliance. So that's what we've done with the pathway under the hood. We've built a tool which will actually recognise the individual characteristics of that home, and where we have access to them, the individual characteristics of the people that live in that home by way of heating schedules, energy patterns and so forth. So when you're starting to say these measures will save X amount of money, yeah, there's a range in terms of the saving, but it's a damn sight closer than a range would be by just taking a standard assessment, because that is a minimum compliance. Does it achieve across the nation? As opposed to does it achieve in Merthyr on a wet Tuesday when they're working from home? Well, that's a very different model that you need to run. And that's what, to get to that cost confidence, you need to be able to model the unique home. And from that, you can then say, okay, well, this is the likely cost saving for this lifestyle in this home. You can then have much more sensible conversations about, okay, that's a capital cost of X, there's a repayment of Y, and no, we can't do this on a cost repayment basis because there's a carbon zero target that we've got to hit come what may. But we can start to understand that journey, and with the longer term view, you can start to see when those costs come through against maintenance costs, against replacement cycles, and factor them in. And I think that's kind of one of the key differences that journey enables. You can start to look at it in that sense. It all comes back to something James mentioned at the start, where we come from a background of housing and construction and energy. And in many ways, what we're doing with CERO is trying to bring housing construction and the energy system to meet halfway. And historically, with our tools in the construction sector, we've always based it on historic energy performances. Again, this is a SAP issue. We use old metrics, we use average carbon footprints, and we say, oh, we've got to get to this incredibly difficult standard. Well, if we agree to meet the energy network halfway, we can look at where the energy grids will end up. So when we're talking about our homes that we're working with, we're saying, well, they might not be zero carbon today, but that home, without any further retrofit, or when it's built new as it's built, won't need retrofit, but it will become net zero carbon in 2030 or 2035, because it will effectively ride the decarbonisation of the national grid as electrification carbon gets lower, because it's built with storage technologies that allow it to demand shift. It can ride that journey and get to net zero much more cost effectively and much, much quicker than just using a kind of a national calculation method that is a compliance tool.
I mean, James, this is one of the reasons why I picked up on zero. I think you and I started chatting about 3-4 years ago, didn't we, James? You picked up on what I did, I picked up on what you did, and I thought, wow, this sounds quite good. What I don't know, actually, I mean, I know you come from BRE originally and an architect. What was your position in energy, or what were you doing in energy, James?
So I was originally a mechanical engineer, so I did a short 5 or 6 years in the automotive sector, and actually it's becoming more and more relevant to my experience now, because we can learn a lot from the automotive sector in
housing. That was mentioned in my last podcast, actually, yeah.
I always use the example, so I was a motorcycle engineer, I always use the example that we'd roll a bike off the assembly line and put it on a rolling road. If it failed, it would go back and get stripped down and rebuilt, you know, and, you know, if only we applied that same thinking to housing. I worked in project development within renewable energy sector, so onshore wind and biomass power stations. So that it was really as the subsidies were being pulled away from large scale renewable projects, the future was in district heating, grid scale storage. Those are the sort of technologies that I was looking at. And actually, at the time and time again, particularly with the district heating, my biggest barrier then was not the fact that we could deliver a good network. It was the adoption by house builders. You know, most of the projects were blocked by housing developers not adopting that solution. So I think I was in a meeting at a local authority, and I kind of turned around in the meeting and said, "Well, we'll build the houses. You want the network? You know, it's going to work. We'll build the houses." They didn't go for that at the time, but it was probably only a few months later that Cero was actually born, because clearly big opportunity. You know, we can move this industry a long way forward, and that's kind of why how Cero came about, really.
Are we building houses for them now?
I won't spill. I think the solutions to net zero in housing, you know, if you're purely looking to reduce the carbon footprint, are great energy system science solutions. You know, in the future of energy is in managing the demand and not the generation. So, you know, the building and the projects that we have, so to use it, the Park Eirin project that we have in Tonnerreval as an example, you know, those homes do have storage. They have, as Lee said, they've got intelligent hot water storage, they've got battery storage, they've got electric vehicles. But they've been built with the ability to adjust those demands, and we're working with Western Power Distribution on those projects, because that site, that 225 home site, is a really good example of what the future could be for demand side management in housing. So it was always a clear opportunity, and it's only going to work at scale, which is why we're putting every effort into scale up really quickly.
Yeah, I mean, that site alone is, to the best of our knowledge, it's the largest demonstrator of its kind in the UK.
This is the one that's been on the Fully Charged show, is that right?
It is, yeah, it's on the Fully Charged show. It had Welsh Government investment from the Innovative Housing Programme and was the subject of a UK-funded research project called Flatline, demonstrating the ability of those homes to shift demand, to effectively turn up and down demand, because with renewable networks at scale, you can't turn up and down the wind or the sun, so you need to adjust the demand to reflect that you can't adjust the generation.
I was just wanted to point out to my audience that we're actually filming this, and it'll be on YouTube. Most of my audience listen to it on Spotify and all the other sort of platforms, but if you want to see what we all look like, you'd have to look at me, obviously, but I am going to put this on YouTube. And also, you mentioned motorbikes. I do know some of my listeners have motorbikes. Have you got motorbikes still, James?
I do. I have a Triumph Scrambler,
do you?
So I can still pretend to be Steve McQueen every now and again.
So, Lee, you came from the gas boiler industry, and as we know, it was sort of an industry that just plodded along, didn't it? And same as house builders, is an industry that just seems to plod along. Since you've been here, you must have seen some exciting sort of transitions.
Since I've been at Cero? Mm. Yeah, it's very fast-paced. It's, yeah, definitely a challenge, I think. To be fair, I genuinely love the fact you and me are sat here right now, Nick. And I know that sounds stupid, but I remember speaking to you first 4 years ago or so, where we both picked up, we met on social media, and the same things annoyed us both. And we picked up on these challenges, and I was talking about wanting to start and get involved in policy, and you were talking about maybe starting a podcast one day. And, it's great. It's fantastic that, you know, you've got this audience, and I think it's, a lovely moment. I mean, I'm not sure what you mean exactly, I'm just waffling now, but what changes within sales in what, sorry?
So obviously, as I've been doing this podcast, I'm sort of aware of a lot of conversations now about energy and stuff that I wasn't really aware of, and I think that's something that's a challenge, because obviously we need to sort of like these two gentlemen here, they come from two different sort of aspects, the energy and the building, and they were two distinct and disjointed entities in their own right, weren't they? Now that, and we needed that merge together, which is why I was fascinated by seeing.
Well,
we've got a problem with the engineers that are obviously doing great stuff. You know as well as I do, I always big up the engineers, but they haven't been trained properly. But there's this disjointedness, there's not this holistic view yet, is there, about how important they are of part of this holistic process?
Definitely not. One of the reasons I think Solar got me on board, it was because of the Optimised Retrofit programme. And yeah, I think we'll all admit there has been flaws in the new builds for some time, but it's one thing to put all this technology in a new build, which you're in control of, but then to try and take that model and put it in retrofit. And don't get me wrong, Optimised Retrofit was very much moulded on let's get the broad spectrum of challenges, you know, let's look at all the different types of houses and all the different, but when you actually start looking at the engineering solutions that are needed within those, that's some journey within itself that's required, isn't it? And it's like you say, those unique challenges you're going to find from not only different properties but different residents and different landlords, and it's that. Yeah.
So I think, you know, it's really vital bringing on Lee's experience, because we want to, you know, reach out to the existing trades and engineers, and we've already got programs doing that, and actually, you know, sponsoring the podcast is kind of also our way of trying to do that, because you get these programs. So Optimised Retrofit will spend in total around 40, you know, over 40 million delivering these solutions. Now, to what level does that start to reach, you know, engineers who are self-employed, who have to come on, you know, have to come on this learning journey? They have to get access to these programs to be able to justify training themselves in new technologies and everything else. So a big part of the program is how do we recruit all the decarb army, as we call it? How do we recruit that and make sure that they're aware of this transition and the access to, you know, what sort of knowledge do they need to get into these projects?
I think it's, yeah, how do we recruit, but how do we demystify, demonstrate the opportunity that's coming down the line? As you know we need to deliver net zero carbon across the housing stock. We know actually in most cases it's possible. And with a plan, then you can implement it in a sensible fashion. But this is a big opportunity for installers. It's actually, I know that the industry used to talk about upskilling. I don't think that's right. I think it's just about becoming familiar with new technologies and getting comfortable with them. This is a big opportunity once people are comfortable with them to start to scale up. But it does involve quality of install, knowing how to do it properly, and being aware, perhaps, for perhaps the ones further from best practice, that more and more homes will have, as we said earlier, that kind of post-occupancy monitoring. So you do have to install it right, because it will be run remotely, whether by us or by others that might come forward in the future, to provide that kind of service and to keep that data flowing from the home. So as they get more connected, we need them to work properly. We need them to work properly for the residents and their comfort, which is first and foremost, to keep their bills low, but also because we've got to get to net zero, and that's one of the ways we're going to do it.
I can't remember the first time I said it, but you've both heard me say it a lot of times after joining you, when I sat on one of the skills discussions about the skills shortage to install heat pumps, and I sat and went, what skills? It's two pipes and a couple of cables. And that's not to dismiss, you know, the challenge ahead, but I was like, hang on, let's be more pragmatic about this. I said, actually fitting a heat pump, it's a box with a couple of pipes and a couple of, you know, cables. The challenge is in effective system design. It's being able to do heat loss calculations and evaluate properties, you know, effectively. We should be doing that anyway, and we're not. That's not a heat pump challenge. That's, you know, it's a cross-constructed series, but it should be separate. And thankfully, you know, the industry seems to be moving in that direction. But yeah, that big perception of there's a shortage of people who can fit heat pumps, I think most installers could fit a heat pump.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of it is around supply and demand, as James mentioned. It's, if the demand scales up, the supply will scale up, and we have to make sure it scales up in the right level of quality, the right level of responsibility and design, and building that into the overall journey of the home for the pathway to get it to net zero. So it's all part of a bigger piece. But ultimately, this is a supply and demand market. Most heating engineers and similar are likely to be, a few big exceptions, of course, but likely to be smaller businesses. They're going to go where the reasonable return is, where they think the opportunity is. And the role for Optimized Retrofit and all the work we're doing as Sarah outside that is to really demonstrate this is where the future can be. And this is where your business, you know, their businesses can grow with this.
Now, I'm going to put a link in the podcast because there is a page, because Zero want to engage with as many engineers as possible. And obviously, I support the work you do and I engage with engineers as well. And I'll put a link in the podcast because there is a page they can go to where they can start this engagement journey with you guys.
Yeah, it's on the Optimized Retrofit website and it just lets you enter your details now. And again, it's just making sure these companies, you know, you're at the table when the information's out there, when we're ready for the next stage and it's time when we need that bigger rollout. And one of the great things that's come from the work you've done on this podcast, Nathan, you know, what we do collectively with the Decarb Army is this, the identifying barriers piece. And I think, you know, that was the whole point of you doing those short bulletins. And but the themes that have come off the back of that, it's, I suppose you could have preempted and guessed them, but, you know, for me, the one with them, sorry, I've just had a mental block. What's
that? Diamond was one, was it?
Oh, no, this is terrible. Paul Williams. Sorry, oh, Paul. Yes.
Yeah. Sorry, Paul.
Yeah, but, you know, the ex who I met as the president of the Chartered Institute of Plumbing and Heat is an engineer, is to be saying he's scared about fitting a heat pump even if he's done the training.
Yeah.
And that he needs that mentoring and needs that support. And to think, you know, I think it allows us to see, well, that's the mindset. I think, you know, there is a theme, most installers are keen, but they're scared. They're scared of the technology a little bit, but they're also scared of investing in the business, of, you know, knowing, feeling a bit unsure, especially after what's happened with recent funding schemes, etc. And, you know, it's how can we reassure that? How do we get the plans in place? So it can help installers, you know, if most people knew there was a 10-year plan, I think it'd be quite easy for us to actually engage people with that. And again, it's exactly what Andy said, it's supply and demand, it's just simple.
Yeah. I think, I think hear people talk about skill shortages. The skill shortage that annoys me because it doesn't get talked about is the skill shortages at the desk and the kind of the FD level. It takes a hell of a long time to replace an FD and allegedly a long time to train them as well. But it's a much longer turnover. Okay? So understanding the cost and how that can be spread through the time, especially for large portfolio landlords, that's a bigger challenge to me than it is to see the skills and familiarity for people that are delivering the real work on the ground.
Now, you guys work with social landlords. What is that space like? Is there good stuff going on in social housing, or is it?
There's really good stuff going on. There's really big ambitions to. I think the social landlords have, you know, the first of all, I mean, in a Welsh context, there's certainly pressure there. To hit those net zero targets. There was a report that Andy was involved with called Better Homes, Better Wales, Better World, which, you know, looked at how we get all our social housing to net zero or, you know, an EPC A within a decade. But actually, you know, alongside that report, they're also looking. I think everyone sees 2050 a legal target for net zero, and that's not a long time frame for an asset owner or a building owner. So they see that as well, regardless of the fact that the actual legal obligations might not have hit them yet. But I think this, what's going on in the market right now with this winter, is just building that case for supporting their tenants with a more efficient, you know, buildings that are cheaper to run. So we find the social landlords are really driven across, you know, those sort of what haven't quite hit them yet as near term targets, but that longer term target of net zero and that you know, sort of that need to cater for tenants and fuel poverty. So we certainly see, you know, and we deal with a lot. We've got over 28 existing partnerships, huge desire to move quickly, but also get the quality, make sure the tenant does have a good experience and get the right outcomes, and actually make sure that, you know, we're measuring the performance. We're making sure that all these things we say we're doing, we're actually delivering in practice.
So Zero, because I think this measuring is fantastic, because I mean, we come from the building industry, kind of, don't we? Performance testing in the building industry is... and I think... monitoring brings in accountability. I mean, everyone thinks we have to have regulations, and I've always said, I'm probably one of the only people who said, well, if you have regulations, you need people to actually go out there and judge whether they've been done. And that has never existed. So most building controllers would have come and inspected me for G3, for instance, like for unvented hot water. They would have been a carpenter or a bricklayer. They don't really know what they're looking at. And regulations, but where's this technology that monitors? That brings accountability in it, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think you used to see in the construction sector, and still do to a large extent, buildings being heralded as they're doing something groundbreaking because they've done a year's post-occupancy monitoring of the building and they've got some energy readings or they've got some internal environmental reading. And that's, you know, that will still occasionally make the cover of a very, you know, construction magazine. Something, someone's done something to actually check they delivered what they were contractually obliged to deliver. And that gets a magazine cover, you know, that's absurd. So yeah, absolutely. I think the only way really in a modern building to retrofit or new build to really check is to see whether it delivers what was promised. You know, and that is done by monitoring. You need the internal environment to a limited degree. You need the energy split down to enough to understand whether hot water is driving the energy demands or heating or whether it's plug-in appliances and similar things. You've got to be able to monitor at that level of granularity. You of course need external environment and other factors to be able to complete the picture. But based on that, you can say, is this building built as it was designed? And if it wasn't, then, well, there's a contract and you need to have those conversations with the contractor and the subcontractor or the installers for retrofit to say, hang on, this was supposed to work like this, it didn't, how are you going to resolve it? And that will very quickly drive quality and delivery because people will learn that it's being checked.
You said, so within the optimised retrofit program, you've got 27, 28 registered social landlords. I mean, can more come on? I mean, can more come on work with Zero if they like this idea?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, our reach as a company is starting. You know, it's just to spread outside of Wales, and we're working with social landlords in England and local authorities as well. But you, absolutely, you know, it's a really important sector because there's an element of there's also an element of control because of the. We can make sure that we're getting that quality because, you know, quite often they're procuring work through their framework. So it does give you that extra level of oversight initially whilst we've got, you know, some of this kind of learning curve. So it's a really important sector to get right. And I think that's clearly from a Welsh Government perspective, they've seen it as a way of, you know, quickly funding decarbonisation because we've saw with the Green Homes Grant, you know, it's very difficult to put a lot of money into the sector and without the right tools and methods to deliver the right quality outcomes. Mm. So I think the approach that Welsh Government has taken is a really good one, which is let's spend some time getting these processes right. Let's make sure that we can, you know, we can quickly pivot away from things that are having poor quality outcomes. We're using good data and the social landlords can really provide a sort of the right initial sort of volume in terms of new technologies, and so I think it, you know, we're really looking to take the principles of this project and expand it out way beyond the sort of 2,000 homes that we're doing.
So a local authority could come to here and think, wow, they offer this great service. I mean, obviously we've talked about comfort as a service, but that's for the homeowner. But the local authority could say, well, Zero will come and help us decarbonise our properties and projects.
Yeah, so we're working with some local authorities in that regard as well, where they hold their own housing stock, and actually having conversations about how we might support local authorities to engage the owner occupiers within their area as well. Beyond the social landlords, we really see the next big opportunity to be through the finance. So we announced only last week that we're working with a Principality Building Society because the next opportunity really is to say, well, let's partner with the people with the money. There's a good opportunity there for financial institutions to fund net zero, and if they've got the right data and tools to be able to offer that additional borrowing at a point in time where maybe the buyer is more willing to do those works, I think that's a really sort of key point of entry for net zero. So yeah, social landlords, local authorities, financial institutions, that's really where our initial focus is.
I might have to have a little think. I mean, I had the special advisor of the Bank of England contact me the other day asking for a recommendation for EPAM. I get these very high profile people coming back to me now to recommend them. So Lee, when you go into these new buildings, I'm talking about the social housing buildings, what sort of technology are you seeing? What's in there existing at the moment?
In new buildings or in existing buildings?
Well, in the social housing buildings. I'm assuming combi boilers are predominant, aren't they?
Yeah. I'd say the vast majority of the properties I've been involved in right now are combi boilers. There's quite a lot of stored hot water, somewhat thankfully. I think we're back to the previous assumptions, where is that the future or not? But yeah, there's still quite a lot of...
So they can be optimised, can't they? There's a pathway of optimising them with the stored hot water, be priority hot water systems, isn't it? Rather than your old wires plans.
Yeah, and it's interesting, you know, when we sit and we look at the measures and do you install a heat pump or do you add the external wall insulation? And again, I sit there and go, yeah, well, what about the pipe work? That's a measure. Let's look at the, you know, let's get, again, you know, I'm not the only one thankfully singing from that sheet here, but it's... Yeah, to look at, get again, one of the, you know, using my background in plumbing to really nail down the big radiators and the underfloor heating and looking at the system as a whole. And the fact that can actually be done in all the various steps, you know, and I've done that for years with customers, where you look at, when you're doing a room up, do that bit of pipework and that radiator. You know, because when you live in a house, you don't tend to rip it apart in one go. So, you know, when you're doing each room as and when, then worry about that bit when you've got the final plan in mind. There's some challenges as well. You know, there are properties out there, you know, especially off-grid ones. We've got some on oil, some on LPG, there's some with direct electric heating, there's still some with overnight storage heaters. And again, in each of these, you know, we're looking at the technical solutions for first, how, you know, they present different monitoring challenges to seeing what's going on in those properties and where the energy's going. But then they might potentially need a different pathway, whether that's because of the fabric of the building or the location or the orientation, how exposed it is up on some mountain or down in a valley, should I say, in Wales.
It's definitely always one of the two.
Yeah, it's got to be one of the two, hasn't it? It's never on a flat plane. No.
Something I always get asked is are there buildings that just can't be worked with, and what are the buildings that... I mean, coming from the building world and in as an architect, I mean, are there buildings that are really, really going to struggle to decarbonise, or and then are there buildings that are really, really easy?
So I think there's a glib answer to that, which I'll give to start with, which is that any building can become a net zero carbon building. The caveat to that is that's not necessarily economic. But in essence, when you look at net zero carbon rather than net zero energy, and you remember that particularly the electricity grid has a very variable carbon footprint for every half hour, or technically every second, but reported every half hour, you can actually approach getting to net zero carbon, if you need to, as something of a trading exercise. So you can draw power from the grid when it's very low carbon, and you can supply power back to the grid when it's high carbon. And even if the grid never achieves zero carbon for any of the kilowatt hours that you're trading, you could theoretically trade your way to net zero carbon. Now, don't get me wrong, it takes a very big battery to achieve that for a building, for a home or anything bigger. But in theory, any property could get to net zero carbon by that mechanism. Now, that's not the most cost-effective mechanism. So it would be far better to take a building through reducing the fabric, reducing the energy demand through the fabric, understanding what the demands are for that individual occupancy, and ensuring that you're putting in highly efficient systems to make the best use of the energy that it does require, and then driving that through and using that kind of balancing ability as part of the suite of exercises. So we would always... For any property we approach, whether new build or existing, we'd always use a mantra of reduce, balance, generate. So first of all, reduce the energy demands. That's fabric first, as the industry knows very well, but it's also system efficiency. Don't forget that reduce involves system efficiency as well as fabric first. Then balance, and that's the bit that the current regulatory tools don't recognise at all. The need to be able to work in harmony with the grid. So when the grid isn't generating, you can run off, and when the grid is, you can feed back and so forth. And then last and least importantly, generate where it's opportune, where it's useful, where it's appropriate. Yet some on-site generation or near-site generation is a really good thing to be doing. But in that order, we'd always say reduce, balance, generate. And so under that metric, any building can get to net zero, but it might depend on quite how heavily you're playing the balance card in the middle there and quite how much that costs.
And some of that bothered me, and again, this isn't the corporate message, it's a personal message, which shocked for me. But when Hull, where I'm from originally, it's gravitated outwards. It's all the new build developments are all suburbs, and it's all, and there are quite large swathes of former council housing estates or areas that where they're literally, you know, they're quite run down, and there seems to be, I guess it is in some scenarios cheaper to build on fresh land than to knock down and deal with what's there. And it's not like these homes have been done up. Generally, there's, that it may not be the case now, but prior to me leaving Hull about 7 years ago, there were whole estates where they'd just been left to ruin because it was cheaper to build a bit further out. And I genuinely think it's part of the conversation that's not had. Where do we need to say, actually, this home? Maybe that is one way we just, it's, you know.
I think that's right, in the sense that there are some which, from an economic perspective, you'd say that isn't a sensible decision to upgrade that property. But I think we need to remember that homes, and we've learnt this lesson from post-war clearages and things, and even pre-war clearages in some cases, where actually there is a lot more about a home and community and local sense, that you have to value all of that in the true sense of value rather than economically costing that before you make a decision. It may still be that some homes are just not worth saving, but actually there is a community that's there that's actually is at least as important and probably more so. But amongst that, you also have to remember we have a really skewed system financially in this world, where knocking it down and building a new home on the same plot is 20% cheaper because you don't pay VAT on it. Whereas if you refurbish that home, you pay VAT on it. Now, that's a fundamental issue that we face. Set aside the community engagement and all the benefits that we can have by refurbishing that home, you've got a skewed playing field in there if you're looking at that model, and that's something that we need to recognise.
I was going to ask you, is there any sort of changes you'd like to see? So obviously that's a change you'd like to see. So there, are there sort of some policy changes you'd like to see to help this whole sort of agenda?
Yes.
I'll stick out with this one.
For me, I think, clearly we need to, if we're serious, and we must be serious about delivering net zero carbon, we've got to recognise that VAT not being present on new build, but being present on many measures for retrofit. Now, some energy are only 5%, but many measures are 20%. That is skewing the playing field, and we are demolishing buildings that we perhaps shouldn't be. So that's an important factor. Mm. I think the other challenge from a policy perspective is most of the regulatory tools, as I've mentioned, recognise energy, and they're not recognising carbon. And that's a fundamental difference. We need to remember that the Climate Change Act of 2008 requires us to achieve net zero carbon, as it was upgraded in 2017, not net zero energy. So we're currently measuring in apples, yet we have a target measured in pears. Why are we doing that?
Can you, for some of my listeners, could you sort of elucidate, explain that a little bit, you know, this net zero energy, net zero carbon, and sort of the differences?
Sure, so it's pretty straightforward. The current regulatory system says if you generate 1 kilowatt hour of electricity from a photovoltaic array on your roof at noon, let's say, and you feed it to the grid, and then later on in the day you draw from the grid 1 kilowatt hour of electricity to, I don't know, cook your tea, boil the kettle, whatever it might be, then the current regulatory system says you're net zero. Now, what we would clarify is that you're net zero energy, because you've generated 1 kilowatt hour of electricity, fed it to the grid, you've taken 1 kilowatt hour of electricity from the grid, 1 minus 1, net zero, job done. When you look at the grid from that perspective, grid energy generation doesn't have a static carbon rate. So at noon, the grid is at the moment, at a guess, probably running, actually we're into autumn, it's probably up to 200, but anyway, say it's 150 grams of carbon that's emitted at noon. So you fed 1 kilowatt hour and you displaced effectively 150 grams of carbon, and that's your kind of carbon credit, if you will. You prevented that from being emitted by the grid at noon. In the evening, you turned on your kettle and your oven and whatnot, and you drew 1 kilowatt hour of electricity. Now, at that point in the evening, the grid is probably generating electricity about 300 grams. So you've drawn you've caused the creation of 300 grams of carbon. Now, your home was net zero energy, but in carbon terms, you've only got 50% of the way there. You still emitted 150 grams on balance because you fed 150 and you drew 300. Now, until we start recognising that difference in our assessment metrics, we are not going to achieve net zero carbon. And it's very important that the industry recognises that our legal obligation is net zero carbon.
Yeah, that was the Climate Act 2008.
I have another ask, actually, which is we need to define what net zero is as a target as well, because until we have a clear definition, now we align ourselves to the UK Green Building Council definition, which importantly includes the people that live in the building and plug stuff in. So until we've got a clear definition, then we will see claims of net zero and zero carbon. And you know, you see it all the time, advertising, so-and-so's building a net zero, like a zero carbon scheme. We just need that definition, you know, and you know, there are definitions out there that, that would be more than appropriate to use. But the sooner we say, right, that is an actual definition of net zero, then we can all start planning towards it effectively. And it starts to eliminate the potential for greenwashing and uncertainty, and you know, local authorities will be clearer about what's being delivered on there. And I think it's, you know, and it should be acceptable to say to a local authority, it's not going to be zero carbon today, but it is going to be zero carbon in 2030, and you know, we're future-proofed against a 2030 standard, which to many local authorities might be a great outcome.
This is a sensible pathway, Greg. Yeah,
recognise that it building to a higher standard today might not go all the way to achieve that sort of holy grail of zero carbon right now, but there's nothing that's going to have to happen to that building in the next decade, and it'll get there with the planned, with the forecast decarbonisation of the grid. So that's why you see the kind of the key thing for Cero is really talking about this net zero by, you know, and it does align very well with organisational targets or local authority targets. You know, you've got cities that have got targets of 2030. Okay, well, let's make sure, and it's a pragmatic approach to the costs of building to net zero. And you know, to kind of validate that, we are building to net zero today in our own development site, and it's expensive. It's going to be a great scheme, and you know, it's going to achieve that target once it's completed next year. But we don't expect everyone should go all that way. We've got to find a way to hit a target that we can achieve.
It's one of the things that impressed me most when I started getting involved with that side, because it doesn't matter. Specifics we won't worry about, but there are developments I'm familiar with whereby the very low carbon houses are almost double the price, genuinely, in the market around me. You know, they're premium, very much premium, you know, projects. And whereas to see what you're doing at Cero and for the cost you are for the people actually buying the houses, I think that's one of the greatest things. And that, I think, is underpinned by the fact you're not trying to do absolutely everything today on these builds, and it's having that longer term view. It makes a huge impact on what's required right now, and I think, yeah.
We just don't want to go back to anything, particularly the stuff that homes that are built new right now. Yeah. We really don't want to have to go back and retrofit them. And every home built to building regulations right now needs retrofitting. So that list is only getting longer.
And yeah, quite significant retrofitting if you're building to just bare minimum building regs at the moment. I think my last policy wish, if I can add one on the tail of the question.
You can add as many as you want.
Would be, I think, where we know, and we've done quite a lot of work where we're working with Welsh Government and talking to other partners across the UK, there is, you know, we're not going to grant fund our way through this. We're certainly not going to grant fund homeowner occupiers. We're not going to be able to grant fund the whole social sector, let alone part of, you know, we need to target the public funds that we've got to the most vulnerable, to those that are at risk of fuel poverty or in fuel poverty, to those particularly difficult cases where homes are perhaps stranded assets, where the community needs investment. Those are the places that we should be spending public funding. What we need to do is enable the market to recognise the ways that homes with low energy demands are more valuable. And we're working with partners like Rightmove and Monmouthshire Building Society and the Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors to help work on that, to recognise the value difference between homes that need to have works done to them and perhaps have what we're calling a brown discount. And we're expecting that the market will come forward to recognise that. So actually, we've all been doing this behaviour for decades. When you perhaps looked at buying a home and you said, oh, I need to get new double glazing, that was actually you chipping the price for a brown discount. What we need to do is expand the number of measures that people do when they go through that purchase process. We need to build those into the lending mechanisms. We need to build those into what people think about as they think about value of their home, so that recognise it. And the biggest policy ask would be to send some long-term signals to the market about how this market is going to change. So I know long-term signals are not what a five-year electoral cycle loves, but if we start as a society to say in 2040, you will be taxed on carbon, I'm not going to say which way it might be, but if we start to report, properties will have some recognition of their carbon footprint in tax in 2040 or 2050. You may never need to implement it, but the fact that the market starts to recognise that's coming will drive the value difference, and it will start to mean that the commercial sector and those that can afford to pay will start to behave, and that's where we'll start to see it tip over and snowball.
You mentioned building regulations there. Once again, you've worked in that world. I mean, are building regulations flexible and agile enough, or are they just too structured?
I think we've actually made building regulations overly complicated. And we recently published our own version of what a net zero home new build specification would look like. And we published that in what the construction industry would think of as pretty plain language. So we talked about elemental U values for walls, roofs, floors, windows. We talked about an air tightness, but we didn't talk about fabric energy efficiency per square meters, which is currently what the Social Housing Decarbonisation Fund is looking at and things like that. That's quite a complicated thing. But when you boil it back down to actually pragmatically delivering on site, if you're talking about new build, if you're talking about brickies on site trying to build a particular performance of wall, well, if you ask them to build a 0.13 wall on every site they go to, morning and afternoon, Wednesday through to the following week, and they're building the same details and they're building them, they're getting the snots off and they're cleaning it and they're tying back the insulation, they're doing it the same way every time, I'm pretty confident that we get a better quality outcome along that way, and certainly what we've seen suggests that. If you're suggesting, which is what the current building regulation systems works, that you have to calculate a fabric energy efficiency standard across the square meterage and the end terrace is slightly different to the mid terrace, which is different to the flat, then you suddenly, as a trade, you're going from one site to the next, going, okay, what am I building here? Is it 0.17 wall or 0.16 wall? And how does the bridge detail work on this? You've got no capacity for standardisation. It also means you've got very limited capacity for modern methods of construction or off-site or design for manufacture and assembly, whatever you want to call it, but whichever acronym you go for, by going to a simpler, effectively an elemental method, you can start to get standardization, you can start to get back to a position where actually building regulations is pretty straightforward. You can recognize if it's done right, because it's done right pretty much the same way on every site, and that rolls through into retrofit as well. I think you can push that through as a site-first approach, what's pragmatically deliverable, and then actually in the societal modeling, the fact that the end terrace performs fractionally different to the mid terrace, that can be taken out in the modelling. You know, that can be waddled out across society. We know that works.
Mm. Well, it all sounds very good. It sounds really, really good what you're all doing at CEO. It sounds like Welsh Government are sort of really sort of pushing for the right measures as well, doesn't it? So that's good news as well. Anything you'd like to add before we wrap up?
Just a thanks to you, really, Nathan. I think you're podcast is a great way to reach out to a really broad audience, and thanks for coming to see us, really, is all my dad.
Thanks for sponsoring. I don't have any old person sponsoring me anyway. I'm quite choosy. Now, thank you ever so much, gentlemen, for joining me on this special podcast, because you are my sponsors. You're doing great stuff, and it will be on YouTube, and please follow, like, disseminate it, share it however you can, and I'll put a few links into. So people like, I mean, you just said there about a report you were putting it, and
yeah.
So where, people can find it on your website? And
yeah, they can find it on the website, but we'll give you some links as well, so you can put that on there if they want to. That tells how we think you should build a net zero carbon home.
Brilliant. Well, we're now off to a restaurant, and I'll probably show the Welsh how to drink. Or maybe not. We'll see. Thank you ever so much, gentlemen. It was lovely to meet you all. Thank you.
Thanks, Nathan. Thank you.